Welcome to the Asbury First United Methodist Church Weekly Sermon. We hope you enjoyed this message by Stephen Cady. For more information about this podcast or other ways to connect, please visit asburyfirst.org.
Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and settle at the furthest limits of the sea, even there, your hand shall lead me, your right hand shall hold me fast. There's some debate about how much of the human population is actually right-handed. But most agree that it's somewhere around 90%. And the thing is, it's consistent across the globe. There's not a single human society that is predominantly left-handed. That's always about 10%. And it's different than the animal kingdom, whereas animals are roughly 50-50 right and left-handed pawed clawed. For us, it's always 90-10. And the idea is that it has something to do with our power of speech. See, our left brain, roughly speaking, controls the right side of our body. It is also our left brain that houses the speech centers for our bodies. So the idea from an evolutionary perspective is that as we grew and as we grew the facility, the ability to speak, that side of our body, the right side of our body, became dominant. We certainly are fearfully and wonderfully made. And while most of us will use whatever dominant hand for most of our lives, not all of us, maybe because of an injury or because a teacher refused to let us do it any other way, we develop some ability to use, at some point, another hand. Maybe if we're a guitar player or a pianist, we might develop great facility with both hands, though true ambidexterity is exceedingly rare. Unless, that is, we resort to torture. Maybe you know the story of Solomon Northup. He tells that beautiful in his beautiful memoir, 12 Years a Slave. It's the story of a free black man from upstate New York who is captured in D.C. and forced into slavery in Louisiana, where he is almost immediately thrown into the cotton field. And he notices lots of things happening in the cotton field, not the least of which is how silent it is. All he could hear was the click, click, click of nails on those hard pods and the whip of the overseer. See, in the cotton field, it didn't matter your size or your sex or your gender or your age. All that mattered was how much and how quickly you could pick, which is why he recounts the story of one woman whom he watched walk down the aisle. Her name was Patsy. She would sort of dance between the rows of cotton, and as he described it, she would use both hands at the exact same time with a kind of nimbleness, a facility, a dexterity in each of her fingers that was sort of lightning fast. It would have been beautiful had it not been for the torture that compelled it, a torture that he described as evidenced by the scars of 1,000 stripes on her back. Later, enslaved persons would describe the kind of mental and physical disconnect necessary in order to make that kind of ambidextrous movement happen. They even had a name for it. It was called slight. Only as one enslaver lamented, not every hand could get the slight of it. This sleight of hand meant that enslaved persons had to literally disconnect that part of their body that allowed them to function They had to sort of disconnect what was happening inside, to let go of that biology, all of that evolutionary history, to let go of it, to let go of their own humanity so that they could work fast enough, not just for a couple of hours, but all day, every day, from dark to dark, until it was just the first hints of the sunshine, until it was too dark to see to pick out the cotton from the weed, at which point they would take all that they had gathered for the day and to weigh it, praying that they would may have picked enough to meet their quota for the day, their ever-increasing quota. If they hadn't, of course, they would be whipped ruthlessly, though, as Northup reports, it was often the best pickers who were whipped the worst. Their slavers always demanding more. And it didn't matter, the next day they would be back at it again. And the next day, and the next, until sometimes they would simply drop dead. Men, women, and children. At which point they would be replaced by another body. And the process of disconnecting their biology and their humanity began again. Some enslaved persons in some places even had a name for those who succeeded in that sleight of hand, that kind of lifeless life. They began to call those who found that trance-like state in which ambidexterity was possible, they described them as zombie. In other words, friends, that pervasive and popular cultural norm of the zombie came from our enslaved African siblings and the lifeless life that they were forced to live, the kind of living dead life in which day by day they were forced to work, sometimes until they quite literally die, but always until they let go of some piece of themselves, all for the sake of profit for people who looked like me. Jean-Paul Sartre once wrote that hell is other people. And when we think about what we did to our African siblings, what people who look like me did to our African siblings, not just in the fields, but in the boardrooms and in the parlors and in their bedrooms, all for the sake of profit, a profit from which we continue to benefit today, a profit on which the wealth of our nation, the wealth of our community, the wealth in some ways of our very church still stands, we may think that Sartre was right. Hell is other people, friends, and we put our African siblings through hell. See, we like to look back on our past with these rose-colored glasses to tell ourselves, well, it happened, it's in the past, it was surely done out of ignorance and not malevolence, which sounds really good and makes us feel a little bit better, but it doesn't happen to be true. We forget that it took a choice. It took a choice by people who look like me to make a decision to codify into law the white privilege, the white supremacy that continues to exist in so many ways in our culture. As Kai Wright put it, we not only had white people so threatened by black people that we put our supremacy into the laws, but we codified the violence necessary to sustain it. No, friends, we put our African siblings through hell. We forced them to make their beds in shale. The least we can do is remember it. But as Wesley Lowery reminded, as I said last week, the American battle has never been about, so while some countries vow never to forget, the American battle has always been about what we allow ourselves to remember. It's easier to just look the other way, to not think about it. But as people of faith, we don't get that choice. No, friends, we have to pay attention to it. We can't just bury our heads in the sand. We have to be honest about where we are. And if we've made our beds in Sheol, then we're going to have to lie in them so that we can find a way to get to the truth to set all of us free, because that is the promise of the gospel. And the only way to do that is together, by confronting the truth together and finding our way. That is what we're trying to do this month and beyond. See, this is our second sermon in a sermon series on the last 402 years of our history together as a country, our last 402 years together on this soil, and we recognize all that has happened to get us to this point. We will not cover all of Black history. That's impossible in four sermons, but our prayer is that in the two sermons that I'm preaching and the two sermons that my colleague, the Reverend Nelson, is preaching, we might begin a conversation that will continue from here, that will continue as we read the book together, 400 Souls, that will continue as we each do our own work to try and figure this out. In these 4 weeks, we are roughly taking one century a week. Last week, we thought about the 17th century, and this week, we moved to the 18th century. And while there's much to talk about in the 18th century, the basic structure, the basic gist is this. We used that century, the 1700s, to finally make formal what had been informal arrangements before. We heard last week about some of those laws that began to be put into place to keep Black people enslaved. Well, by 1705 in the Virginia, what came to be known as the Virginia Slave Codes, soon echoed by all the other colonies, that understanding was made formal. See, not only did the Virginia Slave Codes make it clear that African people were property and allowed their white enslavers any means necessary to keep them in their place up to and including murder with impunity, but it also lifted up white servants as above their Black counterparts. It lifted up white servants, giving them certain inalienable rights, including to food and shelter and clothing and freedom from violence. These slave codes not only determined the property and the torture that was allowed to our Black siblings, it determined who could have sex with whom, it determined who was worth what, and it allowed us to create a system that still exists today in which race is the primary social determinant of health. When you want to know or take a guess about the well-being of someone, their race, unfortunately, can help us offer a pretty good guess. The challenge, of course, is that looking back at that 18th century, we can hear in it so many of the theological and epistemological conversations of the day. We spoke last week, of course, about the church's role in this, that it was the theologians, especially in the 1600s, that leaned back into some of these obscure theological notions. They baptized their bigotry using, of course, the curse of Ham. And then, of course, that passage in Ephesians that slaves ought to be obedient to their masters, that used Christ as a cudgel. Well, it didn't stop in the 1600s. It kept going on. There were other racist theories of the day, and in the 18th century, as the Enlightenment came to be, it was those Enlightenment thinkers who tried to find some of those more obscure racist theological ideas so that they could use them in their own understandings. One of those ideas had to do with polygenesis. Maybe you've heard of it before. It was not a popular theory at the time, but it basically went like this. Whereas the regular story of Genesis is that all of us were descended from Adam and Eve, that is not necessarily the way we fully understand it today, but that is at the time that all people were descended from Adam and Eve, monogenesis. Polygenesis had the idea that white people were descended from Adam and Eve, and Black people, amongst others, were descended from something or someone else. To be clear, it was not a popular theory at the time. In fact, in the 1600s, one theologian was even burned at the stake for suggesting it. But when the Enlightenment came, all of those Enlightenment thinkers found something in that notion, something in that racist, segregationist notion that they could hold on to. Whether it was David Hume or John Locke or Adam Smith or Voltaire or Immanuel Kant, they all found something in it that allowed them to baptize their own racist views, to make a natural reason for a supernatural theological idea. But arguably no one introduced that idea or did more to propagate it than a man known as Thomas Jefferson. Maybe you've heard of him. See, Jefferson wrote two of the most important documents of the 18th century. One, of course, is the Declaration of Independence, in which he ironically claims that all are created and endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, that all men are created equal. But the other thing that he is most known for in the time, of course, was his notes on the state of Virginia, written just a few years later, which arguably did more to perpetuate racist ideas than perhaps any other document at the time. As Ibram X. Kendi has said, it made Thomas Jefferson the preeminent thinker on black intellectual inferiority. His notes on the state of Virginia is not something we teach. Sure, we know about the Declaration of Independence. We teach that to our children, all of our children. But when it comes to notes on the state of Virginia, we don't really talk about that, never mind the fact that for more than 60 years, it was the most read, most widely read nonfiction book in the entire world. And it's hard to underestimate just how pervasive his racist notions were and how much damage they did to our society. From his notion, his racist notion, that black people feel less pain. To the idea of the sexual veracity of their women. To the idea that black people couldn't govern themselves. Of course, Jefferson wanted it both ways. He was known to speak against slavery, and yet in the same breath, he would speak against abolition. But in the end, the proof is in the pudding. Like 10 out of our first 12 U.S. presidents, he was a slaveholder. And we don't know how many children he fully fathered out of from enslaved women. With Sally Hemming, it was 7, but there were more. The challenge, of course, was that these Enlightenment thinkers could have these ideas, these racist notions, these caste system for our society in which always white Europeans were at the top and black people, Africans, were at the bottom. And yet, over and over again, their ideas were disproved. They had to keep looking the other way or tamp down any time they saw things that came out to the contrary. For a people who were obsessed with trying to reason their way into life, they certainly let go of much of theirs. The idea that black people couldn't govern themselves, of course, was disproven not only by the centuries of self-governance that had happened in Africa, but by the fact of the maroon communities here in our own soon-nascent United States. See, when a black person would escape slavery, if they couldn't find their way down to Florida and St. Augustine to try and find freedom in the Spanish colonies, they would try their best to find freedom somewhere else on their own. And so they would often set up these communities called maroon communities, which were self-sufficient. They were often in the worst places that anybody could imagine. They'd be in a cave or in the swamps or in the tops of trees. And yet they somehow managed to survive on their own, long disproving that racist notion that they couldn't take care of themselves. As one former maroon put it, Tom Wilson, "I felt safer amongst the alligators than I did among the white men." Of course, there was always exceptions of individuals who would rise up and prove just how capable they were. Maybe you know the story of Phyllis Wheatley, who in 1761 was sold, having been brought over on a ship that she got her name for, the Phyllis. She was sold at 7 years old to a family who liked her because she reminded her of the 7-year-old that they had lost some years before. By 12 years old, she had learned both Greek and Latin and was starting to write voraciously. By age 19, she had completed a book of poetry. Only before she could get it published, she had to stand before a tribunal of white men, 18 white men from Boston, known as the most respectable men in Boston, all of whom were determined to try and figure out whether or not this, quote, uncultured barbarian could actually have written these poems. There was the governor and future governors and Samuel Mather and the slaveholder, John Hancock. In the end, they really had no choice but to affirm its veracity, having heard just how well she could speak all of the reports. And so, having confirmed the veracity and her publishing the first book by any African-American of any gender as a book of poetry, they began to troop her about as a sort of exhibit, began to take her around as sort of an exception to the rule to see who she was. Thomas Jefferson, in his notes on the state of Virginia, even took the time to demean her gifts, saying that while religion could help her write some poetry, it could not make her a poet. See, in some ways, that is what the 18th century was about. The 18th century was about white people, white men, taking a look at their black counterparts and doing whatever they could to quash their humanity, to remind them over and over again in law and word and verse that they were less than people. Despite the fact that they were 90% right-handed, just like anyone else, despite the fact that they were fearfully and wonderfully made, they did whatever they could in law and lesson to be able to teach them otherwise. There were times, of course, when there were revolts, from the 1712 slave revolt in New York to the Stono Rebellion in 1739. But almost all of them ended in disaster, with the conspirators, almost always men, women, and children, being killed by the worst means imaginable. In fact, there's only one slave revolt that was known to be successful, and it didn't even happen on our shores. It happened in 1791 in Santo Domingo, known today as Haiti, the very place where that idea of the zombie originated. It was right in that place that they found their way to freedom. But in so doing, they made it a little harder for those who were here in the United States. See, in reaction over the course of the next 60, 70 years, because of the success of the slave rebellion in Haiti, Americans put together new laws that limited almost every single thing a slave enslaved person could do, from gathering, from thinking, to marrying. No, let us not forget that our enslaved siblings were trapped, their beds having been made in Sheol by people who look like me, and were forced to live their whole lives there. See, we love to tramp out our Frederick Douglasses and our Harriet Tubmans. And to be clear, they are worthy of our praise and our admiration, but too often we treat them like Phyllis Wheatley was treated, as an exhibit, as an exception to a rule, as a way to make us feel a little bit better about what had happened, that it couldn't have been all that bad. Look at how they made their way through. We use it as a way to try and dismiss our black siblings, to blame our black siblings for their own enslavement. As Kanye West recently put it, to say that slavery was a choice. Well, friends, slavery was a choice, but not for our African enslaved siblings. It was a choice made by people who look like me. It was a choice, not a necessary evil, but a choice, a conscious choice done by Christians who baptized their bigotry for the sake of profit. It was a choice by Enlightenment thinkers who chose prejudice over people, and it is a choice for us about whether we will turn and face it or turn the other way. As James Baldwin has said, not everything we face can be changed, but nothing can be changed unless we face it. So friends, what will it be? Will we turn and face this, or will we turn the other way? The good news is Christ is there regardless. That is the promise of the psalmist. We heard it, right? That whether we ascend to heaven or whether we make our beds in Sheol, God will be there with us. But now the question is that where we want to be? Where do we want to be? Each of us are going to be listening to these sermons over the course of the next 3 weeks, today and the next 2 weeks, and having to ask ourselves, what is my part in this? How can I make a difference? It's one thing to sit and nod. It's another to take that hard look in the mirror and to say, to what degree am I responsible? And if I'm not responsible, to what degree am I accountable to what has happened? The truth is, there are those sitting among us whose ancestors were enslaved. And there are those sitting among us who were part of the enslavers. But all of us have a choice about how we are going to find our way forward from here. The promise of the gospel is that things can change, that they don't have to be the way they are, that what is not what has to be, but it will take each and every one of us doing our part. Because if we don't, if we refuse to do that, friends, then we become our own version of the zombie. Functioning, right-handed or left-handed, but not really alive. The promise of the gospel is that the truth and the truth alone will set us free. And if in the end what the psalmist said is true, that God will be with us whether we ascend to heaven or make our beds in Sheol, then why not try? May it be so. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Asbury First Weekly Sermon. If you enjoyed this message, please visit asburyfirst.org and learn more about our mission to love God and neighbor, live fully, serve all, repeat.